From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Over the last 2 weeks, Sotheby's and Christie's, the art auction houses, sold roughly $2.6 billion worth of art. That's up 25% from just last year, up 70-some percent from 2007. Picasso's Women of Algiers broke the record for a single painting sale price at $179.4 million. And works by Mark Rothko, Andy Warhol, Lucian Freud, and Alberto Giacometti all brought more than $50 million each. High-priced art is this month's face of the world's growing concentration of super wealth. This hour on Point, inside the white-hot market for top-tier art. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you read the meaning of these wild prices? And what does it mean for art and its role? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound of that highest of the high, Pablo Picasso's La Femme d'Alger, a painting sort of 4 by 6 feet, bright for a Picasso, sold for $160 million, $170 million plus with commission at Christie's. This was New York just a week ago. Britt Gorvey, head of post-war and contemporary art for Christie's, was on the phone with the anonymous bidder. The Picasso became the most expensive work of art ever sold at auction. Here's the winning bid.
Value of bidding, thank you so much, at $160 million, ladies and gentlemen. Fair warning, the Picasso Femme d'Alger, selling it here at Christie's, $160 million. Brett, it's yours. So,
valiant bidding. I guess you could call it that. With us now from New York is Charlotte Burns. She's a reporter for the Art newspaper and covered last week's sales. Charlotte Burns, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What was the atmosphere in the room when that painting went at that price?
Well, there was applause, as you heard. You know, everybody knew in the room that it was a record immediately. It had been estimated to sell at around $140 million and guaranteed. So the chances of it beating the previous record, which was for Francis Bacon's triptych at 142.4, were quite high. So people had expectations that they'd be watching a world record as they went into the sale room that night.
Give us some examples of other works that must be going at very high prices to add up in total to this $2.6 billion over the space of a week or 10 days. What else is selling? For what?
Well, there were a lot of the sort of typical faces that you'd expect, really. No major surprises. There were a few Rothkos that sold last week, including one that sold for $81.9 million, a Freud painting of a Sue Tilly, a benefits worker from London, reclining nude on a chair in resplendent glory, sold for $56.2 million. Mondrian hammered at $45 million. You know, tens of millions everywhere, really, particularly at Christie's. The average, you know, as you move sort of midway into the sale of the Wednesday evening contemporary sale, the average lot was around $3 million, I'd say. So we were seeing big numbers.
And a sculpture as well. Giacometti's Walking Man, one, sold earlier, over $100 million for this skinny guy?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Giacometti had been the sort of, you know, this sort of bright spot on the art market a few years ago, I think in around 2010, when his Walking Man became a world record in London. And this was at a point where people thought the art market was in doldrums. So this expenditure on the sculpture sort of cheered people at the time. Now, of course, that looks like a speck in the distance because records have been best and broken every season since then. But at that point, the Giacometti was a record. This is a sort of relation of the same series. This is the Pointing Man. And it sold, I think it hammered at 126. So when you add fees on, that was 141. The interesting thing about that work was it was one of the few lots that didn't come with a guarantee during the sale, and there was only one bid. And it went to Mark Porter, the chairman of Sotheby's America, on the phone. So it did reach a massive price, but usually when you hear about those figures, you expect that there was a great depth of bidding and fighting to get to that point, which was the case with a Picasso. With a Giacometti, it wasn't. Just one bid, world record.
Wow, done. I want to look at what a guarantee means in these atmospheric, super stratospheric prices. But who's buying these? In the Picasso case, we heard them say right there, anonymous. But they're not all anonymous. What portion are, and of those who are named or known, who's buying?
Most of them are anonymous. A lot of the action in the room was basically the auctioneer talking to the staffers on the phone. So you don't know who's at the other end of that phone call. Could be anybody. And that's sort of one of the big changes that we've seen in the art market is this broadening. So there are a lot of collectors from Asia. There were a lot of works that went to Asia last week. And Chinese collectors who made themselves known. There were bidders from all over the world. I mean, they gave some figure after a Christie's sale on Wednesday, I think, saying that most of the works had gone to people who'd only been buying art for the past 3 or 4 years. So we're looking there at people who have become relatively wealthy, and we're looking at, you know, the wider pattern of global wealth. It's a lot of people at the top who become very, very rich quite recently, and some of those people are buying art.
What is driving the prices up so high right now? Is it simply that continuing concentration of wealth? They've got the money and so they spend it? Or are people looking at art in a new way when it comes to money?
I don't think people are looking at art in a new way. I think people are looking at the fact that, you know, art is, the art market is an international thing. So you can buy in one currency, sell in another. It's relatively portable compared to property. It's fairly liquid. There is, it's a networking means. Someone called it the global golf course. You know, if you're a rich Russian billionaire and you want access to, you know, American hedge funders, you can join the art market. The only entrance fee is money. There's no vetting process. So it's a pretty democratic golf course, if you think of it that way, that you don't need to pass any tests or be accepted. You just need to sort of spend money. And I think a lot of those people, it's a means of being part of something, a sort of peripatetic global elite, people who are traveling. And of course, we've been seeing, you know, this is happening against the backdrop of stocks have been volatile, banks have been, you know, haven't been lending. There's been political instability in various regions. So art has seemed to people over the past sort of 6 years or so like some kind of safe store for capital, even if it's not going to. I mean, whoever bought the Picasso at 179.4 million, you're not going to make a big return on that for a while. Those trophy prices aren't necessarily going to be raised anytime soon, but you have just made sure that your money is now worth 179.4 million.
And it's kind of Picasso fungible. You could, I guess you could sell it anywhere. It's not tied to one currency. We've heard the chairman of BlackRock talking about contemporary art as a store of wealth, now more important along with real estate than gold. You mentioned guarantees. How does that work? This is getting kind of financialized in interesting ways. When the auction houses come out in the realm of these enormous high prices, there are guarantees beneath them. Who's guaranteeing what, and who's putting up the money for the guarantee?
Well, there's two different ways, really, of doing a guarantee. One is the third-party guarantee, which is slightly simpler. It means that if you're the auction house and I'm selling you something, you might go to a client of yours and say, will you back this? Which means that you're agreeing to buy it at a certain price. So it's a bid. It's called an irrevocable bid at Sotheby's. It's a bid that you can't take back. And you and the auction house and the guarantor will work out fees for that, and they vary, without getting into too much detail, depending on the house. Sotheby's is public, so it's slightly tighter in terms of if I am the guarantor and I buy the work, I don't get my fee. Whereas at Christie's and Phillips, they're private companies, and you'll still be reimbursed for your risk-taking if you buy the work, which is a slightly different financial arrangement. Which some people criticize for saying it's, you know, a murky situation. You don't know who's buying the work. You don't necessarily know what they pay. You know, if the guarantor of the Francis Bacon that sold, that had a third party last couple of seasons ago, if the guarantor bought that, they'd have received a fee for that. And so, strictly speaking, they're two different lines on a banking ledger. But overall, the money coming out of a pocket is a different amount than the one that's recorded all over the world. But for the auction houses, if they want to do them themselves, they're underwriting the risk. And it's a good means for them of, A, making a greater profit. Their margins have been shrinking recently because of the competition with each other to secure major lots. And it's a way of attracting top-level consignments and giving people that security. Not everybody wants it. The Giacometti pointing man, the vendor of that, he or she didn't take the guarantee, so they took the upside. The person selling it took the upside there. It's also a way for the auction houses to make sure that things are going to go. You know, you're not walking into an auction house with absolutely everything about to go under the hammer with no sense of how the evening will go. Like I said, with the Picasso, you knew going in that that work had been guaranteed by the auction house, although because Christie's had taken the risk, it can then offset the risk. So a third party had bought part of that risk from Christie's. And that isn't announced, and you don't know who that person is.
Wow, it sounds like arbitrage. Art is the realm of truly high finance. Charlotte Bernstein by Lindsay Pollack joins us as well from New York, editor-in-chief of Art in America magazine. Lindsay Pollack, thank you very much for being with us. It's great to have you today. What is selling at these high prices, Lindsay? What genre? What period?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good question. You know, that Picasso, Les Femmes, you know, was practically blinking and flashing. It was so bright. It was so dynamic. You know, you could hang that thing anywhere and it's going to look
fantastic. No one's going to miss it if you've got it up in your mansion.
That's for sure. Although, you know, the sellers who sold it originally in 97 had a whole room full of Picassos in their living room.
Okay.
But the, you know, the work that tended to sell at auction tends to be large, bright colored, you know, sort of upbeat colors. I mean, if you look at, overall, and painting generally, and the artists are typically European American male artists.
So these are like kids in a candy store going for the big bright thing.
To a certain extent, that's not untrue. I mean, conceptual work, work that's very political, does not tend to sell well at auction, and particularly not at high prices.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the white-hot market for super high-priced art right now and how the moves of the super rich are changing art and the art world. Of course, art has always drawn money, but it's the biggest money ever. Here's the bidding for a painting by Dutch artist Mondrian, composition number 3 with red, blue, yellow, and black, sold for $45 million, 50.5 with commission. It was expected or had a maximum estimated value between $15 and $25 million. Here's the winning bid last Thursday.
$44 million. $45 million. And selling. To the fourth row. Up front at $45 million. Fair warning. And selling at $45 million. $45 million. Thank you.
Boom. High and higher. It can go fast. Lucian Freud's benefit supervisor resting. This is picture. I mean, you can see a number of these things at our website, onpointradio.org. There's a gallery of painting images up there. You can see this one. It's in quite large lady, naked, immodestly resting, you might say. And the bidding went very, very fast. Started at $16 million. Climbed quickly.
And $16 million to start it. $16 million for it. That's $16 million now. At $16 million, $17 million, $18 million. At $18 million, $19 million. At $19 million, $20 million. At $20 million. At $20 million, $20 million, $500,000. $21 million, $500,000. Ahead of you at $21 million, $500,000. $22 million, $500,000.
Up and up and up it goes. $22 million, kind of chump change in this realm these days. Lindsay Pollack is with us. She is editor-in-chief of Art in America magazine, author of The Girl with the Gallery, very deeply versed in what's going on in art and art markets these days. Charlotte Burns is with us, reporter for the Art newspaper. They both join us from New York. Lindsay, there's so many implications here, but just think with us for a minute about who's buying. Is it changing, Lindsay?
Well, I would say it's changing in terms of the breadth of the people who are interested in buying. And I do think that, you know, people are now motivated by this sense of investment and asset class, and also this sense of social climbing, whatever you want to call it, Charlotte alluded to earlier. But, you know, 20 years ago, Sotheby's maybe had, and Christie's, you know, a couple thousand clients who had enough wealth to be participating in buying, who were very, very wealthy, able to buy at this level. If you listened to Sotheby's, call about their recent earnings, their new CEO, who'd been on the job for a little over a month, Tad Smith, said there are over 170,000 people around the world with a net worth of more than $30 million in 2014, with a total wealth of nearly $21 trillion. So I feel like, you know, these buyers that Charlotte was speaking about who are new to auctions, you know, they prices don't really mean much to them. They're willing to pay unreasonable prices that have no relation to reality, no relation to historical comparables. I want to call them like no breaks. Mm-hmm. These people have no breaks. They have no compunction that these numbers are outrageous, that this value won't hold, that this is egregious amount of money to plunk down at this time on the planet. And, you know, it's a different mentality. Again, when the women of Algiers sold in 97 at Christie's, the same exact picture for around $31 million, you know, there were a couple of bidders on the phone. And I know that someone who was on the phone with a bidder told me that their client said at around $25 million, that's just too much. This number makes me uncomfortable. This person was an old-time collector. Now, $25 million is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But people had breaks. They had a sense of what was appropriate, what was reasonable, you know, at this crazy level that we're talking about. Seems like, you know, there were, what, five bidders over $120 million for the women?
Wow.
These breaks, gone.
You know, of course, art has always been the caught the attention of the wealthy. I mean, you go back far enough and kings and queens were patrons and dukes and duchesses and all that. Is this fundamentally different from that, Lindsay?
Well, you know, it's a really good question because I the book that I wrote looked at, you know, people like Abby Rockefeller and early 20th century American collectors. And, of course, you have to look at the Gilded Age in the teens and the 20s when you had these Americans with huge amounts of wealth and they were looking at different art that they loved. And look, we're very lucky now we have museums like the Frick that
because
we can all enjoy.
Because of that collecting, yeah.
Because of that collecting. And those people were paying outrageous sums. You know, art dealers like Duveen were making killings by charging people prices that were astronomical for work that was really sought after at that moment. So I think the impulses are still the same. I think it's just broadened and maybe pockets are deeper. I mean, I was kind of flabbergasted that 170,000 people have a net worth of more than $30 million. It just kind of blows your mind. And you know, we keep reading in the news about how the band of wealth is really rising to this very thin layer at the top. And I think this is just a byproduct of all that.
And up it goes. Noah Horowitz with the Armory Show will join us in just a moment. I want to get some callers in for you, Lindsay, and you, Charlotte Burns. Marty in Clarksville, Tennessee. Marty, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering that with the record-setting price they just got for this Picasso the other day, are there any known works of art or paintings out there now that they think would easily beat that price if it were to go up for sale?
Beat $179.4 million. Charlotte, what would you put on the block to try and beat that price? Can it be done?
I think you'd go for a Cézanne. There's works on the private market that have been selling for around the same sum of money, if not more. Cézanne is one of those. Gauguin is another. So you're looking at works from the early 20th century, incredibly rare. You need something that's not going to come to market again in this instance. So you need something that is not an addition, usually, although Giacometti was. You need something that has a great provenance, it's in good condition, and, you know, other examples are in museums around the world. Those kind of paintings, usually paintings, every now and then a sculpture, drive prices crazy. So Cézanne or Gauguin would be my money.
Lindsay, you say no breaks. Can you imagine something topping this? Is it out there now? Are we going to see the $200 million, the half-billion-dollar piece of art?
I mean, if the economy and economic conditions and everything kind of carries forward, I guess it's conceivable that, you know, yes, the record could be broken. I mean, the other painting that was sold in the Gantz collection was called The Dream, Le Rêve, and that made a lot more than this same painting that sold last week at the time. It was owned recently by Steve Wynn. Remember, he poked his elbow through it.
The gambling casino guy. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then
his elbow through it. That's right. Sorry, I forgot that.
But he still sold it to Steve Cohen, the hedge fund guy,
yeah.
And you know, which makes people speculate if maybe Steve Cohen bought the Women of Algiers because it would be nice to have both. But technically, theoretically, the Rêve could be worth more than Les Femmes d'Algiers. I could see it. I mean, given how bananas people seem to be spending money on art right now.
We're talking no breaks and bananas here. Bill in Miami Beach, thank you for calling. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering what the implications are for another part of this market, the, say, signed lithographs by artists such as Warhol and Lichtenstein. Are those going to be increasing in value commensurately? I mean, obviously, they're not the same stratospheric levels, but are they also going up big time for what they're priced in their own market?
A great question. Lindsay, take us across that waterfront. These at the super tip-top, what does it mean for other classes and categories of art as you go down the pyramid?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I really dislike how looking at these big prices kind of makes the whole art market seem like everything is so outrageously priced and inaccessible because, you know, personally, I look at prints a lot and works at multiples, which are very affordable. You can get wonderful things for a few thousand dollars. In terms of pop prints, Warhol and Lichtenstein that the caller mentioned, those have a good solid market. And I don't know this year or last year, you know, where they're sort of trending, but I think that work certainly has a very established pricing points depending on the series and the work and the edition size. But, you know, if you are interested in, let's say, ceramics or glass or jewelry or another category, there's so much more affordable art that I always get wary that this sort of auction scares people away from looking at art. You can go to student shows. There's lots of art. It's really this tiny little corner of the art market that we're talking about here today. Think about so many artists who struggle, whose work is undervalued as far as I'm concerned.
Margaret in Brattleboro, Vermont. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm going to use your word and say that I think this is a grotesque spending of money on something that, you know, I appreciate art and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I love to see it in museums, but you know, I think it just shows how the upper people who have all that money, they just put a blind eye to the fact that most of us in this world, a lot of us live hand to mouth and some of us live on the street.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And it's just, I think it's, Like you said, it's grotesque.
Well, that's the question, and it's not easy to end up on that word. Lindsay, do you put a moral judgment on this? And what about art's role in assessing life and humanity, among other things? Does it warp it when there's so much money around it?
Well, I think you try not to get depressed about it, although I know a lot of art world people do get depressed about it. You know, they didn't get into this field to be surrounded by all this like greed and everything that's flying around. I try to think on the positive side about it. You know, there's a lot of money pouring into art right now. There's a lot of resources available for young artists through nonprofits, through galleries. There's a lot more collectors because there's all this appeal. So I try to, you know, stay on the positive side of it. I mean, what's ironic about all of this, these numbers and these auction prices is really what's going on in art schools right now. Artists are making work that is very socially conscious, very political. I just came back from the Venice Biennale, and that was a complete and total opposite, almost a stance against this commerciality. So, you know, I think people in the art world are really grappling with what does this all mean and this tone deafness of certain collectors and these prices versus a lot of really meaningful work that's being made at the same time.
You, I think, reported from the Venice Biennale that there's a performance space there. On the one hand, you've got these super high, big money pieces of art being sold, but in the performance space, they had people as a work of art reading aloud Karl Marx's Das Kapital. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, that says it all, Tom.
There's your contrast. Charlotte Burns, in your world, is this called grotesque or just business now?
It's not called grotesque. I think the word obscene gets bandied about a little bit. There's definitely an uneasiness. People are concerned about the stability of something that seems so full of oxygen. And you know, its effect on the art world in a larger way, because it is to some extent rippling down through the art market, but in the same sort of pattern that the wider economy is rippling down, as in not that much really. And so there are a lot of artists who are not necessarily feeling the effect. A lot of galleries are struggling. There's a bit of consolidation. People are gravitating towards big brands, whether that's a gallery, whether that's a museum, whether that's an artist, or something that they know. And I think for younger artists, there's a sort of, you have to be aware of the pressure of the market and try and navigate your way around it. Because there is more money and you could probably make a career as an artist, which at other points in history hasn't really been a conceivable thing. So there's definitely upsides to this. It just requires a little bit more care and stepping through. Because it's definitely a patchy market. It's not all the way up. There's certain things about last week that didn't felt a little bit toppy.
Toppy as in maybe bubble time here. Charlotte Burns at Art Newspaper, Lindsay Pollack at Art in America magazine. Please stand by. Again, we have a gallery of a few of these paintings, some of the big sellers at our website, so you can feast your eyes on what went for that enormous money, onpointradio.org. With us as well right now from New York is Noah Horowitz. He is executive director at the Armory Show, big international contemporary and modern art fair held in New York, author of Art of the Deal, Contemporary Art in a Global Financial Market, and I guess that is certainly the case. Noah Horowitz, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Don.
What's the impact of this action in the auction houses for fairs like yours? The Armory Show and others have become big, big deal, the Basels and so on. What's the, is it, I don't know if trickle down is the right word, or the atmospheric effect on your event and the artists who show there?
Sure. Well, I think if you look back over the last 20 or 30 years in the art business, two of the biggest changes certainly have been the globalization of the field. Lindsay and Charlotte have touched on that a little bit. But it's also the event-driven nature of how the business works. There was a moment previously, I think, where you'd go to galleries to source your art, certainly the new art, and you'd go to auctions. And it was principally a professional audience that was going to auctions to buy in the secondary market. And what's happened really since the early 90s has been an increasing event-driven rhythm around everything, where fairs have really risen to the fore as really a pushback, I think, in the gallery segment against the huge resources and giant international networks that the auctions have. So I think it's in a way, have made the gallery business become more competitive. They've driven a huge increase in the number of these fairs internationally. I think last year there was an estimate that there were over 180 international art fairs of substance now taking place. That's up from about 50 or so at the turn of the millennium. And of course, throughout it all, there's an increasing interpenetration between the different segments. So you have the auction houses stepping into the primary market, doing sales with artists like Damien Hirst a number of years ago in London, which was very, very famous. You have the galleries in their own right doing more secondary market business. A lot of the primary market, by and large, even despite these rising prices, for most galleries is a break-even business. So to really stay ahead of the curve and competitive, the bigger galleries or the savvy galleries tend to do a lot of secondary market business, which of course is the auction house's domain. So we see all of these boundaries blurring. And I think at the same time, things are becoming more international. And I think we look down the road, I think a lot of these things will start to look a little bit different. I think there's a moment now where we're really at a crossroads between you have this huge growing and thriving fair segment, this enormous auction segment, and then you have everything else. And I think it remains to be seen what else comes out of that and what these different businesses will look like in the next decade and forward.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. Glad you're joining us for the On Point podcast, sponsored by Audible.com. Many of the books featured on the show, like John Swed's Billie Holiday, The Musician, and The Myth, are available for you to listen to whenever and wherever you wish on Audible.com. It's like having your own personal library with over 180,000 titles that you can enjoy while driving, on the train, just about anywhere. As an incentive to get you to try this service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint, and you can get started today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the white-hot market for super high-priced art. Lindsay Pollack is with us, editor-in-chief of Art in America magazine. Charlotte Burns is here, reporter for the art newspaper. And Noah Horowitz, executive director of the Armory Show, big show in New York, and author of The Art of the Deal, all here for your questions. Here's another in this flurry of super high-priced sales recently. Mark Rothko's number 10 sold for, $73 million at Christie's last Wednesday. Bidding was tight between two callers, but Christie's Lisa LaFaire from their contemporary art department got the winning bid with commission added. Total sales price, $81.92
million. At $73 million, Anna Maria, you're out. And I mean, last chance, Selling here the Rothko of 1958 at $73 million, ladies and gentlemen. Lisa, the Rothko is yours at $73 million. Congratulations.
Boom, it's yours, just $73 million. Or here, sculpture of a pointing man, bronze sculpture, very, very slender. Alberto Giacometti sold for $126 million, 141.3 with commission, set the record for the most expensive sculpture ever sold. Again, just last week, anonymous bidder, Christie's.
At $126 million then, with Mark and selling. Fair warning, here it is, at $126 million. Zin? $126, last chance, selling here to Mark's bidder at $126 million. Sold to you, Mark, at $126 million.
Huge, huge numbers. Lots of response online on Facebook. Eva says, safe investment plus need to launder money. It's one way to do it, I guess. Bill says, simply egos. Lejeune says, more money than they know what to do with. Scott says, at our website, let the uber rich spend their money on buying art and not politicians and lobbyists. Maybe there's a thought. Susan in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in my studio right now, brush in hand.
Great. What do you think about all this?
Listening to this conversation, I was a graduate student at the School of Visual Arts in New York City in the early 80s, and like this is a conversation that was going on then as well. I didn't feel like what I was doing related at all to what was going on in the auction houses in New York. I still don't relate to any of it. But I was wondering what your guests might think about what is the difference other than the prices. What's the difference really in having a bubble in the 80s which burst and then having a bubble now?
I promised to ask them, do us a favor first, Susan. It's so nice to have an artist with brush in hand. What are you working on? Take us to the art.
I'm painting. I actually paint sort of religious art, so mm-hmm. I'm painting the archangels right now.
And what colors are you working with today?
Very earthy tones. I've been very interested in icons, and particularly Ethiopian icons. So these are more in the Ethiopian style, very earthy browns, reds, golds.
I love this.
And then I'll do gold leaf.
and are you thinking, I don't know, structurally or right now, or are you thinking, feeling emotionally, what the work you're doing this morning? What's the motivation?
Oh, definitely emotional. I'm not thinking about who's going to buy it, how much it costs. I generally think about that maybe afterwards, but that's never been my motivation. I just have always been an artist and always been a painter, and that's why I do it. So I think that's why this, you know, really dramatic, high money investment kind of attitude towards art is something that I don't understand. And when people, one of your guests mentioned this, when people ask me, you know, I'd love to buy some original art, but I can't afford it, I send them to the art schools in Boston, to open studios, wherever they live, because there's tons and tons of art out here in the world. And it would be nice if the uber rich would support their local artists. And maybe I can understand having an attitude of wanting to invest their money in something that feels safe, but I also think there is an opportunity to buy things that you really love and that you want to live with, not that you want to, you know,
put in a vault.
Security guards around.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I guess for anybody at almost $200 million, security becomes the issue. We're so much happier for you to take us to your Ethiopian earth tones and religious icons and brushes. Susan, thank you very much for that. I'll take your question to our panel. Thank you for calling. Charlotte? We had a bubble before. Susan wonders if it's a bubble again, and if it bursts, what's the impact?
Well, we've always had bubbles, and we'll probably continue to have bubbles going forward, whether it's tulip crisis or art crisis. There'll always be something that's popping somewhere. I would say the difference now is that it's just a larger market. So we had the last major recession was in the 1990s when the Japanese left the market. Mm-hmm. And that led to quite an entrenched recession that lasted well over half a decade. Whereas now the recession that happened in 2008 globally impacted the art market for about a year or so. It was pretty small, and ever since then, prices have gone much, much higher. So I'm sure things are bound to, and in fact, what we're seeing is that certain markets are collapsing along the way. I mean, if you look at the market for artists like Damien Hirst, who Noah brought up, was a record-breaking artist in 2008 on the eve of the Lehman Brothers collapsing. Damien sold a lot of his works directly at auction, did very, very well. And now Damien Hirst, you know, he's not a darling of the evening auctions in any sense. His works are often in the day sales. His prices have gone down. Same with Murakami, who is another sort of poster boy for that previous boom. Same with Richard Prince. So you're seeing that, and they're the artists who are still back in the market in an auction. For every artist who makes it to some kind of record, there's about 149 who didn't, and they're forgotten. I mean, go through old mags from, you know, the 1990s or 2000s, even, you know, 10 years ago, you'll see artists who just aren't even spoken about anymore. Things move very fast and people get left behind quite quickly.
Lindsay Pollack, explain then how it's not just old masters at all who are selling at high prices, maybe the highest, but still very high prices. Christopher Wool last week had a show at the Guggenheim recently. He's only in his 50s. He's been selling things at very high prices. If people are looking at these as investments, how on earth do you know what a contemporary artist's work is going to be worth 5 or 10 years from now?
It's a good question, Tom. And Christopher Wool, you know, happens to be a really excellent artist, an important painter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, are his paintings worth $30 million? I'm sure he and his art dealers were pretty aghast at the level of prices paid for his paintings last week at auction. And I don't think it helps the artist any to have prices so huge, because then how do they even, frankly, sell them? Becomes really complicated. Mm-hmm. There are, terrific artists out there whose work do not command any numbers in the realm of $30 million. But there seems to be, for certain artists who the auction houses have kind of cultivated a market and new collectors are seeking, you know, the prices are, you know, $20, $30 million. I think a Doig painting of a man in a canoe went for around $20 or $30 million. $20 or $30 million, sort of the new number for living, contemporary, established, mid-career, very successful, you know, auction-branded artists.
Noah Horowitz, how does it affect the life and work of the artists themselves who are somewhere near that arena?
Well, I think certainly the broader subject, also to the woman who dialed in, who's painting in her studio right now, is you know, the great professionalization of the trade. All of these different factors have commingled together, really from the young age on up, through the art schools, to have people that are, or to produce a generation of artists that are more and more focused not just upon their core work, which remains the essence of what they do, but how they market it, how they take it out, and how it's tended to from start to finish. And I think that's a huge difference in how things are done nowadays. It's not totally new. Howard Singerman, who's here in New York, is the dean of one of the great art schools here, wrote a book called Art Subjects a number of years ago, which really looked at this phenomenon. And it's very important, I think, to point to that, because it's something that's taking greater hold today. But it's not new in and of itself. I think to Charlotte's point a moment ago, also with regard to the boom and bust of the bubble, I think it's certainly the case that bubbles will rise and fall. A few years ago in 2008, when the bubble burst, I mean, it was pretty significant. There was about 35% of the market value was taken out of the market year on year. And it was actually only this past year, at the end of the year, when the sales totals were summed up, that we actually exceeded the overall value of sales that were being conducted at the height of the bubble in 2007. So just to that point, I think the thing is that these markets are cyclical. But what's happening now, to Charlotte's point precisely, is that things are speeding up and that they're a lot more globalized. And I think it's all of these factors that make a difference and that are being rendered now at a greater and greater pace.
You've talked about what it means for the pace of production of art and strains on the supply side. What do you mean by that? What are you talking about there?
Well, I think that there was a moment, you know, perhaps a romanticized moment, when an artist would toil in his or her studio, create a work of art, and it would just be put out into the world. And that still occurs, but the channels that it goes through and the intense involvement that one has in every phase of that evolution of the artwork is tended to more and more knowingly with a greater and greater target and how to work the system, so to speak, to create value within that. Artworks, as we all know, have no real intrinsic value, unlike, say, gold or even, say, real estate. There's a perceived value that's associated with that artwork that has everything to do with who owns it, to who writes about it, to where it's being shown, to who you hang out with as an artist or what galleries show your work. And artists, I think, are more and more in tune with that reality, as are the different constituents or the different actors that make up the art system. And all of those things come together to create value in our business. And I think that one of the key shifts that's taken place recently is the extent to which all of the nodes within that system are actively managed.
The selling of the art. Lindsay Pollack, I think you were at some of the previews before these recent auctions and heard some of the selling of it, the kind of patter. You described it as almost a kind of performance art now in itself. Give us a sense of that, Lindsay.
Well, just, the way that these things are marketed, the dramatic dark lighting, having these well-dressed, and pardon me, Charlotte, but everybody seems to have a real fancy accent who works at an auction house, kind of prattling on about the work and basically saying nothing of real, any kind of art historical concrete, facts, or it's just kind of sales stuff like you'd hear if you went to a car lot on some level. So, that's what sells. I mean, that's what the audience is looking for. People are looking for sound bites. It doesn't have to be that profound, So people who, I speak for The Critic and for a magazine that takes money, tries to refocus people's attention away from business, away from mm-hmm. money, back on the art.
Yes.
And so, we're waiting potentially for a bubble to burst. So people will stop looking at art through a cloud of money and dollars and start looking at art, on its own merits and about its ideas and
yes.
things that we write about. I mean, while all the numbers in the art world are pumped up on steroids, the readership of contemporary art magazines are flat. Critics are paid the same amount they were paid, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So curators as well. Curators are really poorly paid, part of the art world. People who are doing the rigorous thinking are really not valued right now. People who are selling, buying are the ones who have all the power. And, so if that changes, I won't say that I'll be devastated.
I guess not. Eric in Miami, Florida. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to make a point in regards to the art, especially the high-end art, not trickling down to the lowest common denominator. As an example, the street artist Banksy that comes to New York and tags a building, tags a door, and then 10 minutes later, the door is sold for $15,000. And apparently there were a group of people with fistfuls of cash running around, not worrying about what the art exactly looked like, just worrying about trying to get a piece of it.
And what do you take from that story, Eric?
It's the art world going awry.
Yeah, let me just hold that one. The Banksy with his $15,000 door in 10 minutes, and get one more, if I may. Nancy in West Newton, Massachusetts. Nancy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. It's Nancy Schern, and I'm a duck lady.
The Make Way for Duckling sculpture in the Boston Public Garden. Wonderful, of course. Thank you for calling, Nancy Schern. What do you think?
Well, it's a sad commentary that we have to be dead in order to make all that money.
Not everybody's dead. Not everybody.
No. But people seem to think that the cities pay for the public art sculpture. It's not true. People who, and we really have to support, as one of your people said, we have to support the young artists coming up because the cities don't pay for public art particularly. I know about that. Mm-hmm. We have to raise our own money, and that's a sad commentary as well.
There's a contrast. Wonderful work like yours, and it's just not operating on that same plane. I mean, we're grateful for that because we can see it. Lindsay, what do these high prices mean for what the public actually gets to see? Are we going to see more and more art turned into a super treasure and locked away in vaults and not seen by most eyes?
You know, I don't actually think so, Tom, because a lot of these Uber collectors these days, because of the tax structure in the United States, maybe elsewhere, you know, they're opening these private foundations, which granted, you know, aren't as easy to get to as the new Whitney Museum where you can just hop on over. But a lot of these collectors are making their work available in order to get some kind of tax benefits. And I think the work will eventually end up in museums. So I don't think we can be too sad about this work going away. There's so much terrific work. Anyone who wants to see it can go down to Chelsea on any weekend day and see, you know, dozens of exhibitions for free.
We're all for that. Noah Horowitz, ultimate impact on the art produced in our time, up, down, or neutral?
Up.
Because the market's there and the market's hot.
Well, because I think there's more opportunities for artists. I mean, I think Lindsay pointed it out before, but we've never had a market in which so many different artists and practitioners and writers and commentators have had the opportunity to partake in something meaningful and to get their work seen. The internet, which we've not discussed at all in this conversation, has had a huge impact on that as well. But I think that overall the net benefit is hugely positive. Even if the risks and all of the aspects of it are also accentuated.
Noah, we're out of time right there, but it's so great to have you. Noah Horowitz, Executive Director of The Armory Show, Lindsay Pollack with Art in America, and Charlotte Burns with The Art Newspaper. Our thanks to all three. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.